Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Julia Angwin talk about the many ways that government, private businesses, and criminals can and do collect our private data. Julia shows that because of the pervasiveness of the surveillance system we live in today, we are in danger of becoming a society that self-censors itself instead of demanding our rights.
You have many useful tips about creating secure passwords. And I felt, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to remember them. I mean, like everyone else, I have the obvious one with an exclamation point or something put at the end of it. And now I realize I'm a complete hack. What do I know? I just write about privacy. What's the takeaway for how people can create passwords?
So passwords are a terrible situation right now. So I guess what I ended up doing was basically using a password manager, because there's software that will just generate passwords for you, because it's impossible for anyone to try to come up with all of these passwords themselves. And then I hired my daughter to use a special technique where she rolled dice and picked words out of a dictionary, and then she strung those words together so that I had 5 random dictionary words, and I used those for my super secure account, so for my email bank and for my password manager. If I was going to say one thing about passwords, if you're going to do one thing, anyone, please just change your email password to the longest possible thing and write it down. The myth you can't write these things down, no, the likelihood someone's going to break into your house, get your wallet or the piece of paper, and then figure out that that's your Gmail password, very low.
I mean, you just pick a long word you remember, like supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Well, the longer it is, the better, because the password hackers, their programs are designed to just try each letter of the password. So the longer, the better. But if it's a well-known phrase like that, they're more likely to guess it. That's why I do random words from the dictionary, because those programs are not likely to guess those random words. And also, I would just point out that we think we have a good ability to create random words, but our minds are not that random. So it is really better to try to come up with a way to find really random words.
And again, just for those who are not privacy paranoids, why is this important? What's the mud puddle test? And, you know, why should people take the trouble to create?
Well, so passwords are actually really important. Even if you don't believe a single thing that I've been saying about privacy, you don't want to be hacked. And it's becoming incredibly common. And so it's just really important, particularly your email account can be used to reset all of your other passwords and to get into all your accounts. And so criminal hacking gangs are basically very expert at breaking passwords. So just that, even if you don't believe in privacy, change your password.
Would you have taken all these steps if you hadn't been writing the book? And will you continue to use these technologies?
You know what's interesting is I definitely started this as an exercise to see if I could do it and if I could educate myself and to investigate whether how hard it was to protect my privacy. But what I found is it's sort of like becoming a vegan. It's a way of life. It's like every day I have to wake up and choose not to use bad passwords and to choose to put my phone in a bag and to choose to not give my real name at the barista and, you know, everything. And so it has become a way of living. And it is kind of a pain, to be honest. But one, I really actually think that it's important for myself, for my kids. I've taught them all these things so that they won't wander into the digital world, sort of burying everything and building a long trail that will always be with them. So I think it's worth doing. But some of it is impossible, right? The phone, basically, this is kind of, even I admit, this is not a good solution. In fact, the reason I do this is to show that maybe we need another way to block tracking other than technological means.
Should get to questions because they're so excellent. There are a whole lot of them. So let's jump right in. Why is the average person so unconcerned about privacy rights? We all seem so willing to give up personal information.
Well, it's because we don't know the true cost of it. We're getting all these free services, and we love free. Everyone loves free, right? And what we're now waking up to 10, 20 years into the internet revolution is that they weren't really free. We were paying with our personal data. And now what we don't know is how much is that data worth? And it's a very uncertain time. We just don't have a way to quantify it. We can't tell how it will be used against us in the future. We can only speculate. And so I think it's perfectly rational to be confused about whether you should care, because this is an opaque market. It's like the bond market. You don't know what the prices are, and it's only the true experts who can really evaluate the price of their data.
Google claims it never shares a person's search history with anyone else. True?
Yes, Google says that. I mean, what's interesting about Google and Facebook is they have so much data themselves that they don't want to share it. They don't tell it. They keep it for themselves. They buy other data from the data brokers to enhance their profiles so that they have the best profiles out there. The problem with that is that the government is always at Google's door. I mean, we have seen that they come to them with these requests for data. We also saw that they had hacked into Google's data centers to get it when they couldn't get it through the front door. So by putting, I like Google, I would like to trust them with my data, but I don't know if they can defend themselves against the NSA.
Speaking of which, here's a great related question. If the Fourth Amendment requires a search warrant to search my home, why isn't a warrant required of the NSA to search any computer in my home?
Right. It's because of the third-party doctrine. Basically, you put it on... I mean, if they go into your house and take your computer physically, they should warrant. But these days, it's so easy to remotely get the information from your computer that there's many ways to circumvent that search warrant requirement.
You talk in the book about this exciting case from California, the Cotterman case, where the Ninth Circuit just last year said computer searches, even if they're done at the border or outside the home, can potentially reveal so much about us that they have to be minimized and the police should only be able to look for information and not seize anything. And might that go anywhere? It's a very interesting
decision. Yeah, I mean, I think that was such a ray of hope, right? That was the first time that we'd seen any sort of limits, right? Right now, what happens is at the border, this happened to David House, a WikiLeaks volunteer. You know, they basically knew he was coming back to the country from an international trip. They took him aside, took his computer, copied the entire contents, and then let him go on because it's a perfect, they didn't have to get a warrant because there's an exception. And so it's been a tool that they've used to find information from people who they want to track but don't want to get a warrant for. So that was a great moment that maybe there will be a standard, that legal standard required at the border, but so far that's only in one circuit.
You invoke the general warrants that sparked the American Revolution, the John Adams and the other framers like James Otis,
yep.
So concerned about these pieces of paper that allowed the king's agents to search anyone's house to search for seditious material or evidence of people not paying taxes, that they fought the revolution because of it. Is NSA surveillance like a general warrant, or because it's just metadata, that is the telephone numbers rather than the content, is it not like a general warrant?
I mean, I don't see how you could look at a collection of every single phone calling record for the past 7 years in the United States as anything other than a general warrant. I mean, it was it's the hugest database of connections and associations that possibly ever amassed, and that's what the NSA was doing with their 215 program. Now, they say that they didn't actually collect it. It's just sitting there, and they only collect it when they do a search in that data. And I think that's like a legal technicality that needs to be sorted out by the courts, and maybe they're right, that it just doesn't exist. It's sort of like a tree falling in a forest if no one hears it. If it's sitting there and it's never touched, maybe we're okay with that. What I'm concerned about is what's the level of oversight to make sure that somebody isn't getting it? Because right now we're in a world where there's no data, it seems, that is safe. Edward Snowden himself walked out of the NSA with a lot of files he wasn't supposed to have. And so it's hard for me to trust their assurances that no one is looking at this other than these few searches.
And just to be consistent with the Constitution Center's nonpartisan mandate, the lower courts are split on this question. One judge, Judge Leon, in Washington, has says James Madison would have been appalled by the PRISM surveillance program. He would have been aghast about the slow incursions of liberty. Another judge in New York has reached the opposite conclusion and said because of the third-party doctrine, we don't have expectations of privacy in phone numbers we turn over to the phone company. Justice Scalia has said that he expects the Supreme Court to hear this at some point. Next question, if I try to hide my personal information from the NSA, won't that encourage them to do more surveillance about me?
Yes, it will. So, it will. So we saw in some of the early Snowden documents that by using encryption, for instance, which is something I use as much as I can, you know, putting my messages into secret codes that can't be read by the government or hopefully will be really hard to read, I guess. We don't know yet whether they've broken it entirely. That it puts you on a suspicious list and it allows them to store your data longer and keep it for analysis. And so I recognized early on in my project to protect my privacy that many of the things I was doing were likely to actually raise red flags. But I did it as a way of protest in some sense because I basically felt like that isn't fair. Just because I want to have a conversation that isn't read by someone else with my mother, I don't see that should put me on a list, and I sort of protest that assumption. So I went into this knowing that it might raise suspicions. I've not yet been detained at the border, but I expect it to happen anytime. And I think that we just have to think about whether that's the right standard, whether we want the NSA. They do work for us, after all. Like, is that what we want them to do? Maybe.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And the secondary pat downs are a pain, but they haven't led to more trouble so far.
No, I do. Yeah, I do the pat down every time. I don't do the body scanner because, you know, seriously, like, they have enough data about me. They don't need my naked body picture too.
Just on that point, that was the one victory for privacy in this whole sorry tale. The government initially had these choices between the two scanners, the naked machine and the blob machine. One shows you naked, the other makes you a nondescript blob, which for most of us is an act of mercy. And they could have picked, both were equally effective. They could have picked the blob machine. In fact, they rolled out the naked machine, and it took that great political protest, the guy who a few years ago exclaimed at the border, "Don't touch my junk," the Patrick Henry of the body scanner movement.
Yep.
They went back to the drawing board, and President Obama was shocked to discover he could actually retrofit the naked machines as blob machines, and now, and most of the big
now we're all blobbed.
We're all blobbed.
Right. I'm still not blobbing.
You won't even blob, as a matter of principle.
I just don't blob as a matter of principle, because there's so few opportunities to vote on this topic. I want there to be metrics.
Great.
So everyone says, oh, no one cares about privacy. You can see, you know, I was at Denver Airport, actually, I saw a sign, which is 95% of people opt into the body scanner. And I was like, aha, see, I'm the 5%. I want there to be numbers, because they don't present it to you as an opt-in or as a choice, right? That's, you know, and so I, in some ways, a lot of what I'm doing here is sort of calling the bluff on the opt-in and opt-out situation. They're always like, oh, you choose. Well, okay, I'm choosing. Right? Count me.
Who else would opt out of the body scanners? This is a very pro-privacy crowd.
Yeah.
Very, very impressive. Isn't Google a hypocrite for complaining about the NSA when Google is more invasive?
Well, Google's still not putting anyone in jail. I think that Google has a right to be upset. I mean, when they found out that their data centers were being hacked into by the government, and after that, Microsoft came out with this incredible statement. They said, we now consider the government, the U.S. government, to be our largest threat. Previously, it had been Chinese hackers. So they're like, basically, like, we're putting the NSA at the top of our hacking concerns. And so the tech companies are in a difficult position, which is they're in the U.S., they have to comply with the law, but I think they seem to be legitimately outraged that there was a lot of covert stuff going on. They were complying with these secret court orders on the front end, but they were unaware that the stuff was going on the back end, it seems.
Does the current Supreme Court understand enough about technology to make an effective privacy ruling? Justice Kagan has said she's the most tech-savvy justice, and she remembers playing Pong as a kid. So.
I have to say, I went to hear the U.S. v. Jones oral arguments, and there was this great moment where Chief Justice Roberts said, wait, you mean they could track my car with a GPS tracker? And I was like, yay! Right. So I think they're starting to wake up to this. I mean, how can you live in today's world and not be aware that this thing is transmitting information about you all the time?
They are reading briefs on iPads. They're understanding text messaging. I mean, how do you have to be really tech savvy, or basically the principles are broad enough that you can understand them without getting into the weeds?
I think that, no. I mean, look, the level of tech literacy in this country, I think, should increase. People are still a little bit too confused about sort of like the level of tracking that happens behind the scenes on websites. But there's been so much press about it that you'd have to be living under a rock, I think, not to know that, which may be where the Supreme Court is located. But
well, but the Jones decision was 9-0. That surprised a lot of people. But not a single justice accepted the Obama administration's position that we have no expectation of privacy in public against ubiquitous surveillance.
Right. And I would also point out that there does seem to be an incredible movement across the country against drones. So many states, almost a dozen, I think, have passed laws limiting drone surveillance. So I think we are coming to the conclusion that when we're in public, just because you can fly an airplane or track a tracker to our car doesn't necessarily mean we've given up our privacy.
Is that to care about privacy, people have to be able to relate it to their own lives? Is that because we can imagine what it would be like to be followed by a drone?
Yes, it's very visceral, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. These are completely great questions. Does the NSA and the government make an extra effort to get privacy information about reporters?
Well, I wish I knew that, right, since I'm a reporter. I mean, I think the evidence is unfortunately leans towards the answer being yes, because there was an Inspector General report a few years back about the FBI's use of national security letters targeting journalists and obtaining secretly information about their phone call records. We've seen that in the Jim Risen case, where this is a New York Times reporter who said that his phone records were obtained for a leak case. So I think we have to say that reporters are probably in a very difficult situation right now.
And six threatened prosecutions under the Espionage Act of 1917, more than all other administrations combined, including some question about whether or not publishers themselves could be charged.
Yeah, I mean, it's a, you know, if you don't care about privacy, that's fine. But I think it's also worth thinking about the challenge to journalists as an issue for our democracy, because journalists are supposed to be the watchdogs of democracy. And if we cannot have any contact with a source confidentially because everything is surveilled, and that we can only rely on sources who are willing to basically move to Russia and give up their entire lives, like Edward Snowden, we're not going to have as much of an ability to be a watchdog on our government. I think that's a question for our society to grapple with.
Have there been many or any legal cases where online browsing data has been used against defendants, not Facebook cases, or against job applicants?
I'm not sure if there have been explicitly. I mean, one of the problems with this information is that oftentimes if you're denied a job, you wouldn't know why. But it's pretty difficult for an employer, I would imagine, to get the online browsing data in most cases.
Based on First Amendment issues and surveillance concerns, why should we discuss this issue on Twitter with the Constitution Center?
That's great.
Excellent question.
You know, that's a good question. People ask me all the time why I'm on Twitter, because I quit Facebook and LinkedIn. Well, I didn't quite quit Facebook. I left a little page here, it was kind of snarky, that says, I'm not here, I'm on Twitter. And I think that Twitter is a little more clear about its issues. It's public broadcast. It's like publishing in the newspaper to me. I put on there exactly what I would write for the consumption of the whole world. What I don't like about Facebook and LinkedIn is that your associations, your list of friends and contacts are basically public. And, you know, we all think we're incredibly unique, but in fact we basically like the same movies, music, and have the same political beliefs of many of our friends. And so our associations can be very revealing.
And Twitter and Facebook and Google all have different standards for free speech and what they'll remove. Twitter is the most speech protective and will only take down speech that threatens and is intended to provoke imminent lawless action. They basically adopted the U.S. First Amendment standard,
right,
whereas Facebook and Google have community standards that allow more speech to be suppressed if it offends a religious group, for example, although not a religious leader. So maybe people should inform themselves about the different standards.
Yes, Twitter has been incredibly aggressive on defending its users' right to free speech.
On that point, we're living in a world where Google and Facebook have more power over who can speak and who can be heard and who is private than any king or president or Supreme Court justice, and yet the First and Fourth Amendments apply only to the government and not to Google. Do we need a constitutional amendment to protect free speech against Google and Facebook and privacy in a digital age?
Wow, I hadn't thought about that before, but that is an interesting question. I do think that we have to sort of evaluate when we go on to Facebook and Google, we think of ourselves sometimes as being in like the public square at a town hall, in a way we're really not. We're kind of in North Korea. We're like in a totalitarian dictatorship where whatever they decide is the rule for speech. And we have to think about whether we want, I mean, personally, my decision is let's not have the speech there. You know, I'm sort of opting out to a different way, but you could also force them to try to have free speech standards. And that there is a precedent for telecom companies having to abide by some standards for First Amendment. So that's a possibility.
We unfortunately have to end. I could continue this all afternoon. You end your book by talking about reforms. You're skeptical about the consent model because you think people might sell their privacy in exchange for a toaster, and once they sell it for a quarter of a cent, they might not be able to get it back. But you like the model. You like transparency, as Louis Brandeis did. And you like the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which tells people how much is being collected. And you have five questions that should be asked of every digital dragnet to decide whether or not it's fair or even legal. Shall I read them, or
yes,
do you want to tell us?
Yeah, you should read them, because I might.
Five questions is a lot to remember. Does the dragnet provide individuals with legal rights to access, correct, and dispute the data? Is the dragnet too intrusive for its purpose? Does it benefit society? Does it fall into the ugly abyss of racism or other prejudice? Can it withstand public scrutiny? These are wonderful questions that I think jurors at the time of the framing of the Fourth Amendment would have asked. Tell us more about these principles and how optimistic you are about them being adopted.
Well, I wish I was more optimistic, but I think that I feel like I'm sort of asking for not that much, but probably people would disagree. But I just feel that I wouldn't mind trading my data for services if I could have some assurances that if it was used against me, I would have some rights, that I could challenge the data, that I could see it, that I could sue over it, and that it was being used in the public benefit. It wasn't for to being used against me. And so I basically came up with these standards as a way of my own thoughts about what would I want in order to trade my data and feel confident? Because I feel like we are in an information economy, and it's going to be although I've tried to opt out, it's not actually practical. What I would rather do is participate freely and have some assurances that I won't be harmed. This is how, cars are incredibly dangerous, but we get in them every day because we have some assurances that some safety measures have been taken and that we have redress if something goes wrong. And I want a similar standard for treatment of my data.
Wonderful.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Paranoia strikes deep into your life, it will creep. Starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop.
And now for something completely different.